You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. In Baltimore, Maryland, the Radical Anti-Imperialist Network, Yellow Springs ARA, and Bold Print Media Collective sponsored a rally at Harbor Place, speaking out against consumerism and war on the biggest shopping weekend of the year. Reem Kadhuda, Pacifica's Peace Watch correspondent at Pacifica Station WPFW in Washington, has more.
Diverse groups rallied Saturday in Baltimore with a clear message against an attack on Iraq. In this typical poor working-class city in Maryland, they marched on City Hall to link their issues at home with the build-up for a war against Iraq.
Many, many, many things are going to be on the chopping block come January. So our struggle to stop the war is very much linked with what's happening in Baltimore City and Maryland State.
Only an hour away from Washington, D.C., Baltimore's mall on the harbor has been attracting billions of dollars from tourists, while its per capita income is still $16,000, and almost 20% of its population living on less than $10,000 a year. This makes the cost of a war unacceptable.
The most conservative estimates for the cost of the Iraq war are about $200 billion. That could wipe out more than four times the deficit of all the states in the United States who are facing budget crisis.
These costs are of particular concern to the unions.
There's trade unions all over the country coming out against this war. I think we're going to get the Baltimore Teachers Union out against the war. There's trade unions. This situation is just insane. It's not just about Iraq and it's not just about oil. It's about, everybody here knows this pretty well looking around, it's about taking away our rights. And it's about taking away labor rights. You know, they're attacking longshore workers out on the West Coast. They've just taken away union rights from all these workers and the federal government by putting them in the new Homeland Security Administration. I hope everybody just keeps fighting this. And I hope we remember that this isn't about stopping a war that hasn't started yet. And this is a war that's been going on for 11 years.
Using a build-up for an attack on Iraq to take away people's rights in the USA is a concern for many in Baltimore. Speakers at the rally reminded us about the responsibility for all in uniform, particularly the police department in a city known to be the most violent in the United States' 25 largest cities.
Today it's Iraq. Tomorrow is Baltimore. And right now, the powers that be are putting people in place to run state agencies. Even though you might wear a badge and a uniform, you subject your children to the same thing. You must show that you have a moral conscience, that you stand for something, that you're not about just violence and killing and locking people up. The uniform shouldn't define you. You should define the uniform.
Eric Easton is another community activist from Reservoir Hill in Baltimore City. He gave tribute to a great anti-war activist from Baltimore, Father Philip Berrigan.
The warrior for peace, Philip Berrigan. He wants to see no one left behind. That's why he was part of the Catonsville Nine, a man of God like no other. He was ordained a father and brother. He tried to be swords into plowshares because to the average man he knew war was not fair. Against an evil system he did joust. That's why he started Jonah House. The high and mighty trembled at his name because they knew for him war was no game. His inner strength made him a great man. That's why we mourn the loss of Philip Berrigan.
According to the organizers of the rally, the very corporations that are funding this war and making it profitable will be raking in profits from both the lucrative Caspian region oil and the consumer frenzy going on in America. It seems that billions of consumers' dollars are expected to pour into multinational corporations such as Mattel, whose CEO is on the board of directors for Unocal War, the number one supporter of the war, and BASF, notorious for making chemical weapons while the nation prepares for war on Iraq. Thanks to Hakam Takash and Ingrid Drake from the DC Co-op Training Program for production help on this segment. For Peace Watch, reporting from WPFW, Pacifica Station in Washington, D.C., I'm Reem Kadhuda.
More than 500 people gathered over the weekend in Cleveland, Ohio, on a very chilly day for a march and peace rally. It was, in fact, the second major anti-war demonstration in Cleveland since the passage of President-elect Bush's war resolution. And some believe it signals a growing movement for peace in the Midwest. Evan Davis from Columbus, Ohio, was there.
With a stiff Arctic wind blowing in off of Lake Erie, more than 500 people braved the snow and sub-zero temperatures for a peace rally in Cleveland's downtown square on Saturday. Veterans and students, trade unionists, and community activists gathered to hear a list of speakers, which included Congressional Representative Sherrod Brown.
We who are opposed to this war are a majority of people in the United States of America. We have to keep speaking out. We can stop this war. My mail against this was 30-1. People are speaking out against this war. We know it's not a good idea. You in the next month have to continue to educate people in church, educate people in your neighborhood, educate people in your workplace. We can stop this war from happening.
Brown also warned of the international implications of going to war against Iraq, especially with regard to other nuclear nations and their potential response.
Now understand, if President Bush goes into Iraq unilaterally, as he wants to do, understand what message that sends to the rest of the world. It means that Russia is then emboldened to go into Georgia to chase down Chechen rebels. It means that China is emboldened to crack down even harder in Tibet and maybe invade Taiwan. And it means in the Indian subcontinent that Pakistan is emboldened to go after the Indians, and India is emboldened to go after the Pakistanis.
Cleveland, Ohio is in the heart of the country's northern industrial belt, and the trade union movement is relatively strong here. Representatives from the Cleveland area AFL-CIO were on hand to speak, as well as a number of rank-and-file members who took part in a march after the rally to the federal building. John Ryan of the Cleveland AFL-CIO.
On behalf of the 100,000 members of the Cleveland AFL-CIO, we stand with you and we stand with peace, and we stand, of course, with the working men and women or overseas, or here defending our nation. But we stand against any first strike against Iraq.
I got done speaking, and Barb and I came back from the podium, and three union members who are rank and file people came over to me and said, "We're so glad you did this." So certainly many of our folks were ahead of us. It's, you know, today's military are working class people, and that's a huge concern. That's our number one concern. Second issue is the amount of increase in military spending is really scary. $100 billion of additional monies to the military, not just for this war, not even with this war. And, you know, that's money that we clearly want a strong defense, but pumping that amount of money in the middle of a recession into the military is really something that should be going for education, should be going for health care.
My name is Rick Toth. I'm an electrician with the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 673. And I'm here because I think George Bush and the administration is planning an attack on Iraq. I think it's going to lead to a whole lot of bloodshed that I think is completely unnecessary. I'm not willing to give up either one of my sons for what really amounts to an oil war.
Are your sons in the military currently?
No, they're not, but they're draft age.
The peace movement in this part of the country is hardly an urban phenomenon, as local suburbs and rural communities also have protests and regular meetings. Your sign says Euclideans for Peace. Does that mean that you're from Euclid, Ohio?
Yes.
Is there an active peace movement there in your town?
Yes. We've just started. We showed the film, Paying the Price, Killing the Children of Iraq.
How has the public reception been to the events that you planned there?
It's been pretty good. Most of the people that we've spoken to are against the war. Mm-hmm. They're like, no, this is not it. We need money here. Let's not spend so much money elsewhere for a war that doesn't pay anyone but the rich.
Nathan Ruggles is an organizer for the Campus Green Party in Akron, Ohio.
Well, down in Akron, the response has been better. We've had peace vigils every Friday afternoon at rush hour since the week after the bombing began in Afghanistan on October 7, 2001. And the response has improved from negative response to, as people are waking up to what's going on, they're realizing that what's going on is wrong, and our response has been more and more positive as time has gone on.
Many student groups have been active in the anti-war movement here. We heard from one speaker from Case Western University.
I'm angry at what we let this country do to the people in our streets and in our planet. I'm angry at the injustice that characterizes American history. I'm angry because we can't grasp something greater when we are so close. Individual action can only take us so far. We, the people who believe in something greater, are united by one truth, that this place and this planet and these people, all of them, are important, not because they're American, but because they're global citizens. The only way to stop injustice is to do this, not in spite of our differences, but because of them. Not in spite of our many visions, but because we have many visions. It needs to be about building something in America and across the world. This isn't justice. What America fights for is privilege. And if you're not angry yet, I don't know what else I can say.
Cleveland's own Reverend Marvin McNichols, a longtime civil rights activist, closed the rally with a rousing speech.
But there is an anti-war movement in this country. There are those of us who believe that war only leads to war and death and destruction, and therefore we are the ones who are the best celebrants of the Christmas season, because in the end, it is not about war in Iraq, it is about peace on earth, not just peace in our nation, but peace in all nations. And so we leave this place with only one thing on our minds: no more lies, no more deception, no more blood for oil. Peace on earth, beginning here, extending for as far as the world can reach, beginning on today, for as long as it takes. Let there be peace on earth, and let it begin with us. God bless you, everyone.
For Pacifica's Peace Watch, this is Evan Davis in Cleveland, Ohio.
As the anti-war movement struggles to stop another war against Iraq, veteran anti-war activist Tom Hayden spoke recently to members of Southern California Americans for Democratic Action. He addressed how the movement can break through the media blockade on Voices for Peace and what questions need to be asked.
I don't need to tell you that the anti-war movement today does not have a voice in the public debate equal to our numbers. There are occasional exceptions. There are occasional exceptions, but in general, the corporate media has ignored or trivialized the hundreds of thousands of people who have already marched in Washington, D.C., in San Francisco, in London, more recently in Florence, and the hundreds of people in Los Angeles who seem to be on a perpetual long march from weekend to weekend. The talk shows are filled with these right-wing pundits or former military and intelligence officials. Most of them failed military officials, but they never include anti-war critics with valuable experience in opposing military intervention in Vietnam or Central America. This has become so embarrassing lately that the New York Times and PBS, which are considered on the liberal side of the narrow spectrum of American opinion, both had to apologize for radically undercounting the numbers of people at anti-war demonstrations. So I propose that we talk about speaking truth to people and let the people do the job of giving the power to the truth. We need to reach out to the many millions of people in the potential audience for the anti-war movement. We've reached a size where we have every right to be on the mass media, and it's extremely important that we see ourselves not trying to tell the truth to the Bush administration, which is absolutely tone-deaf and disinterested, but we do have an obligation in every way possible to speak truth to the American people. And that's a distinction that I think we need to make. We need to question whether a Homeland Security agency makes us safer or is really a re-slicing of the bureaucratic baloney. We need to question tax cuts for the rich when our power plants, our ports, and our infrastructure are exposed to a terrorist attack. We need to question whether the war in Iraq is worth $100 or $200 billion, 2 to 4 times what we spend on public schools. We need to question who decided that the United States should become an empire instead of a democracy, and whether it makes sense to rehabilitate nuclear weapons for possible use, or whether we should spend $100 million and send troops to protect Occidental Petroleum's oil pipeline in the quagmire of Colombia. We should, in short, be asking why the Bush national security policy still makes us nervous. We are spending billions and billions for empire. But middle-class incomes are stagnant, and we are on top of the industrial world in the gap between our rich and poor. Our total contribution to the United Nations anti-poverty programs, those are to combat immediate hunger, malnutrition, illiteracy, and so on, water pollution. Our contribution is mathematically zero of our gross domestic product. It's 0.13%. Where I come from, mathematically speaking, that's a zero. And that makes the world a more desperate place, not a safer place, as does our support for the World Trade Organization, the International Monetary Fund, and the World Bank, with their economic policies that leave 2 billion people a day working in sweatshops around here for less than two American bucks. The test of foreign policy, it seems to me, is not whether it makes the world safer for oil companies or cancer-causing petrochemical companies or multinationals of any kind, but whether it can assure literacy and clean drinking water for the children of the next generation. We are unable to pass that test. We are the richest country in the world, and we do not pass that test. We are in the grip of a corporate mentality so ferocious that we are setting our sons and daughters in harm's way as we become a status quo power using military superiority to prop up advantages for ourselves at the price of opportunity for the world's children. We are stealing the future in order to prop up privilege for ourselves now. We are 5% of the planet's population consuming 40% of the planet's resources. 5% of the world's population, but understand this, we have 25% of the world's inmates. And we still say we are unsafe. 25% of the people behind bars in the whole world are prisoners in our prisons and jails. Where does this end? Where will there be a vision of peace instead of permanent war? We are sending tanks into the Middle East to preserve our rights to drive gas-guzzling SUVs at home. We are starting wars on gangs in Los Angeles when we haven't built a high school in the inner city for 25 years. My friends, these are more than cases of wrong priorities that can be easily righted by a little tinkering with the budget. These are evidence of something at bottom profoundly dysfunctional. These are symptoms of a systemic problem. These are signs of being trapped in bodies, as Bill Clinton used to say when he was a candidate, that are brain dead. So it's not a light matter to embrace the idea and have confidence in the idea that another world is possible. We could build on the original vision of the United Nations to ensure that a new world order includes human rights and labor rights and environmental protection at its very foundation. We could start with a 3 mile per gallon fuel efficiency increase to eliminate the need for Middle Eastern oil. We could make a fivefold increase in our contribution to global anti-poverty, illiteracy, and clean water programs, an increase which would measure our compassion at just 1% of our gross domestic budget. A fivefold increase would get us to 1% of our GDP. That would not be enough, but it's better than zero. And that's where we are, I'd like to suggest. We're at zero. That's why we're so desperate. We're running on empty when it's time for a whole new direction. Steps like these, and people like yourselves to demand them, would improve our safety in the world, leave plenty of dollars for national defense, be popular with voters if there were candidates with the spinal cords necessary to stand on these issues, and would make us, and I mean this in all seriousness, much prouder to be Americans. Thank you very, very much.
Tom Hayden is the former head of Students for a Democratic Society. He also went on trial as part of the Chicago 7 for his involvement in protests at the 1968 Democratic Convention. Thanks to Peace Watch producers Armando Gudino and Dan Pavlish at Pacifica Station KPFK for preparing that segment.
Seven seas, relative humanities. Everywhere I look, I see someone looking back at me. Nation states and borderlines, divided states of mind. Politics comes to blows, and everybody wants to know, whose world is this? Whose world is this? Whose world is this? First world riding high, second world standing by, third world under fire. Funny how we all conspire. We don't know, 'cause we can't see how such a way could come to be. Riding on a spinning wheel, soon enough will be revealed. Whose world is this? Whose world is this? Whose world is this?
Jim Page, Whose World Is This? Gulf Wars, both old and a possible new one, are the subject of a new multimedia exhibit first created a decade ago by Brooklyn artist Nora Ligorano and Marshall Reese. The sculpture, titled Breakfast of Champions, consists of a breakfast table upon which there is a thick Gulf War edition of the New York Times, along with the coffee, toast, and checkerboard tablecloth. But instead of a front page photo, the Times has a TV monitor saturated with the sounds and images of the Gulf War as presented by corporate media. Peace Watch's Robert Knight traveled to Ligorano and Reese's studio in the post-industrial artistic community of Williamsburg, Brooklyn, for a taste of the Breakfast of Champions exhibit.
We are determined to knock out Saddam Hussein's nuclear bomb potential. We will also destroy his chemical weapons facilities. Much of Saddam's artillery and tanks will be destroyed. Our operations are designed to best protect the lives of all the coalition forces by targeting Saddam's vast military arsenal. Our operations are proceeding according to plan.
You just had a view of the Breakfast of Champions. It's a piece that Marshall Reese and I made in collaboration in 1991, and it's a piece about the Gulf War.
It's about empty calories and about how the government spoon-fed us and the media. Breakfast of Champions is an average American breakfast table with a newspaper on top of it, a video newspaper. And we made a composite New York Times over the period of the Gulf War. It's a combination hangover, deja vu, and nostalgia when you read that basically all the major players from the Gulf War, the Desert Storm, are still here.
It's uncanny, and it's really disappointing. And we've actually gone backwards. We haven't gone forwards. And I am really curious to bring this out into the public realm again, so that other people can see that we've regressed in a sense.
Basically, it's everything's the same. Again, as same players, same types of manipulation.
And also, I mean, as this piece is a comment on media and exactly how the media was directed to report a war that happened in 1991.
They were spoon-fed the war, as all of us. The total information access was manipulated. I mean, there's only one reporter, American reporter, in the Desert Storm, Peter Arnett, who stayed in Baghdad. Everyone else was corralled in, I don't know, I guess I would call them focus groups for the military.
Do you feel that news and access to the process of war now is also being spoon-fed as it was in 1991?
I think it's always being packaged as a consumer product. I mean, you want people to watch your news station, so you have to give the right product, and you have to give it the spin that you need to keep your viewers. That's the reason for us couching this piece as a breakfast table where you are consuming your first meal of the day. And in this case, it's the empty calories, as Marshall said, of the media.
Does anything come to mind in terms of commercial, corporate, or mass media coverage that replicates the sense of limitation or control that existed in the Gulf War?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think basically the Bush administration's introduced a whole new word into our vocabulary, which is weapons of mass destruction. I mean, everyone says it. It's almost as if it's not four or five words, it's one word. And I'm very disheartened. I mean, you look at people already now in the networks, broadcast designers are designing the logos that will go, you know, be the breaks between the news and introduce segments. It's really disheartening.
And almost disturbing, because one has the presumption that the two of you are the artists, and yet you're saying that the serious news presenters on the networks are artists creating works of news with the logos and so on.
Yeah, well, you mentioned the artists of the news. Well, I think it's more artifice of the news. That's what it is. It's artifice, not artist. And I just think that it's really being able to present unpleasant facts as pleasantly as possible so that people aren't disturbed by the actions that the military and our government is taking and will take.
Well, it's also about entertainment.
I think that someone viewing this work for the first time on the eve of another incursion into the Middle East will be profoundly affected. I mean, I just think that, first off, everything looks familiar. I mean, it's the breakfast setting, newspaper, and I think that when people really investigate it, I mean, that they actually look at it, they'll see that there are a number of details that are more than just familiar. They're repetitive and they're reoccurring.
I just think people are going to find it really disturbing. It's highly disappointing to find ourselves now that we have de-evolved and we have not gone beyond these kind of quests for oil, et cetera. I just think it's going to have a profound effect.
Is this a parable of repetition, or is it a cycle which is capable of change depending on the action that one takes?
I think that there are two movements that occur in parallel. I would say that repetitive actions is I would characterize it as conservative action, and I mean the reliance and belief in, say, petroleum as an energy source, and this war is also about that. And then, in a way, to renew and recycle the gestalt, or, you know, the zeitgeist, the moment, I think that that's more a progressive or liberal energy. And so I think that in this case, we're just seeing, you know, like a machine hammering us, you know, because, and that's the only thing you can do. And what it's going to require is people to move off that, circle off it, and somehow try to make changes.
To roll in, you have to line up a line, a bomb fall line, they call it, on the target, and it rolls down to you get a death dot on the target, release the bombs, and pull out.
Breakfast of Champions will be featured at the Critical Consumption exhibit opening January 30th at Brooklyn's Rotunda Gallery. Marshall Reese and Nora Ligurano are also the curators of Pure Product USA, an internet gallery of political art where they sell their other authentic works, the John Ashcroft Snow Globe, Newt Gingrich's underwear, and authentic Bible belt. They spoke with Robert Knight of Pacifica Station WBAI. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced by Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is Granger Helvey. We had production assistance from Adil Hamad of KPFA, Kehinde Garrison, Tom Gomez, and Lucy Murphy. Thanks to Pete Caracas, RadioForAll.net, and Shane Rock at WebActive.com for web help. Copies of this program can be ordered from the Pacifica Radio Archives by visiting their website at PacificaArchives.org. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Thank you for listening.